on this episode of Skeptico.
The fact that someone like Neil deGrasse Tyson could come out and publicly endorse an idea with the implications that the simulation hypothesis has, I think is noteworthy. You know, the point is that the idea is catching on, and people who are recognized thinkers are saying, you know what, the explanatory power of this model is just too great. It solves a lot of problems that are unsolvable under the strict materialist paradigm. And this is what bold scientists do. They look at something with a lot of explanatory power and they say, you know what, somebody has to step over this line, and I'm going to do that.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and today we look at the simulation hypothesis. You know, this is an idea that's really been kicking around for a while now. I mean, ever since the Matrix films, remember those with Keanu Reeves? Fantastic films, the red pill kind of thing, the very Gnostic idea, although don't tell any of these modern day scientists anything about it being a Gnostic, very, very old idea that we kind of wake up into this reality that's created and run by someone else. Well, that's the idea of the simulation hypothesis, and it's really caught a lot of attention lately. You know, Ray Kurzweil with this singularity idea, that is the idea that in the not-too-distant future, computer power will exceed the power in our brain, and once we reach that breakthrough point, it's no holds barred, because the computer will just get smarter and smarter and smarter until at some point it far exceeds our ability to even understand or comprehend its knowledge. So that's one jumping off point. The other jumping off point, very interesting, is Tom Campbell's Theory of Everything book, which, you know, I interviewed Tom a long time ago. The interview never made it on Skeptico. It's probably the most requested interview I've done that I have not published. And the reason I didn't publish is I had technical problems with the audio and it just didn't come out. But this simulation hypothesis thing has continued to gain momentum and traction. And as today's guest, academic-turned-filmmaker Kent Forbes, explores in his film, The Simulation Hypothesis, this is an idea that's gained an extra boost with none other than Neil deGrasse Tyson coming on and saying there's a 50-50 chance that we live in a simulation, which it always strikes me as a maddening idea, as does all this computer-centric philosophizing about the nature of consciousness that never mentions consciousness. I mean, Dr. Tyson, if we are the creation of some higher intelligent alien being that allows us to play this game, why and how would we ever be allowed to step out of that game? But moreover, how can we ever have this discussion without immediately talking about God? You're a well-known atheist and a popular speaker at atheist conferences. Yet the simulation hypothesis you're endorsing has direct implications for God. You're suggesting there's an order and a hierarchy to consciousness, and that we're somehow down here and that there's these higher levels. And that leads to only one place that I can see, G-O-D, or whatever you want to call it. Take the religious part out of it. I'm not a religious person, but we're talking about some kind of supreme being. And as we've talked about so many times on this show, once you step over and look at the extended consciousness realms, that's a reality. It's just that science, if you will, is backing into that same reality without wanting to really face it. This is the infinite regress problem in reverse. So the way the story is told, the cosmologist postulates that the Earth is actually flat and supported on the back of a turtle. And then someone asks, well, what's the turtle standing on? And he thinks about it for a minute and he says, well, he's standing on a turtle as well. In fact, it's turtles all the way down. Well, in this case, we have to reverse it. If there's an intelligence smart enough to create a simulation that we live in, then what is the intelligence that's smart enough to create that world that they're in? And you infinitely regress to some point where you reach something that most people would associate with this idea of a supreme intelligence, a supreme being, in other words, God. But on another more mundane level, at least mundane in the way that we talk about it here on Skeptico, what's being left out of this discussion are all these questions about the nature of consciousness. Now, to Kent's credit, Kent addresses that fully, completely, head on And he addresses how the nature of consciousness question is central to not only the simulation hypothesis, but to reductionistic, materialistic science, the kind of science that Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson and every other mainstream scientist endorses. But fortunately, as I said, today's guest gets it. So let's get on to my interview with the creator of the Simulation Hypothesis movie, Kent Forbes. Today we welcome Kent Forbes to Skeptico to talk about his terrific film, The Simulation Experience, which, as the name suggests, explores this idea that we've kind of touched on in this show a couple times, that the best way to understand reality is really through understanding it as some sort of simulation, computer simulation. It's a very intriguing idea and a great guest with some terrific ideas. Welcome, Kent. Thanks for joining me on Skeptico.
Thank you, Alex.
So why don't we start with just the basics? Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to start Fairwind Films, an interesting name for your company. And as I told folks in the video introduction, quite an impressive kind of mission statement you have for that. So maybe you can roll that in. And then about your academic background, too, because people need to understand that you are bringing a level of scientific and academic rigor to this topic that we don't usually see. And that's one of the things that's really refreshing and terrific about the movie, and we'll get into a little bit, is, you know, you gotta buckle up your thinking cap here and be willing to at least tiptoe into some science that you drag people through. But that's the full assertion of your argument is a scientific argument in favor of your position. There, I've laid too much on the table, but let's roll it all the way back and tell us a little bit about yourself, your background.
Well, first of all, I guess I'd like to say that I'm a filmmaker and an artist, you know, primarily. Going way back, I studied theater in college, technical theater. And then I worked in Hollywood and learned about editing and how films are really constructed. And I went back to school and studied theology at Cal and was introduced to, now I was raised as an atheist, okay? So I don't have a dog in the fight religiously, right?
We all have a dog in the fight, but you're saying you didn't have it from your childhood or upbringing or
right? Well, yeah, I mean, I still really don't. I like to think of myself as a pretty objective, open-minded person, but the assumptions that I was going with were just the major assumptions of Western society, you know, which is what you're taught in school, which is basically materialist science. And if you believe anything else, you're kind of foolish or you're investing in mythos or whatever. While I was in Berkeley, I became aware of IONS, which is Dean Radin's Institute of Noetic Sciences, and then also the Center for Theology in Natural Sciences, which is an institute set up to study the boundary between religious thinking and scientific thinking and sort of how those two areas of thought interlink and relate and clash. And looking into the science of the unknown through what IONS was doing, trying to reach over into non-physical phenomenon, okay, mental phenomenon, and seeing what was happening in the study of how science and religion interrelate, I became very interested in how, there's a sort of binary approach in Western society towards this. You're either in one camp or the other. And for me, what emerged was an understanding that it's what's happening is that people have an emotional response to these worldview narratives that they receive.
That's interesting to know that that's your background, because the film just approaches it from a very straightforward standpoint of saying, let me share with you the history, which I think is phenomenally important. You do a fabulous job of tracing this history and letting us know how our understanding of this science has been obscured in just the most kind of deliberate way, that there's a history there that you reveal that is well known, but just not well taught. So I'm asking you to maybe shift gears for a minute, but respond to that. What was that process like for you, discovering that the science of quantum physics? I love the point in the film that you have, and I'll probably show a clip of it, where, you know, you say, here's the 1927 conference. What is that conference?
Solvay Conference.
And you're going, here are 16 Nobel Prize winners. And you're going through them one at a time and pointing them out. And you're saying, this was the issue of the time with the greatest thinkers of Einstein, of Niels Bohr, of all these people. This was the central point. And yet our modern science pretends like, oh no, that's was never really an issue, or it's all was resolved. Speak to that for a minute, would you?
Well, sure. I mean, I'm going to try to put it into the context of emotional bias. At the time, the greatest thinkers were having to confront their own bias, right? And they came out of it, I think, with the best possible conclusions that could be expected from any human beings that were faced with this dilemma. It was a paradigm shifting moment to think that this is happening in that long ago, and that it still hasn't filtered down to the classrooms, you know, to the science classroom. I mean, it's unbelievable. Now, Einstein was able to hang on to his bias towards materialism right until, you know, literally months before his death.
Right.
And you know, the mounting evidence and the tipping point in the community and the consensus amongst physicists had already taken place. And here he is, you know, like, just rejecting that stubbornly. And this is Einstein.
This is not how this is passed down to us, is that history that you're saying. It is the truth, but it's obscured in a way, in the way that it's passed out. There's, there was this big debate, and we don't know, and Einstein never really could decide, but right?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's skipped over in a way to minimize the conflict, to sort of suggest that no, there's this overriding consensus from the beginning, and that is not true at all. As outside of the box as Einstein was, it took him right until the end, but he did shift his thinking, and very clearly says so in his correspondence with peers at the end of his life, that, you know what, we need some kind of a new theory that can speak to the problem of matter is not the base constituent of reality, but we don't even have a way of talking about this. So that's what the sort of information theory and the simulation hypothesis is, Einstein's dream in a way, because it fills that gap perfectly. And I wish he were alive to see how that has come around. And I believe he would be satisfied with it. Now, I kind of wandered off the topic there.
I pulled you off the topic. Let me pull you back to the film itself and the creation of the film, because I want to read for folks a second, and I read it in the introduction, but from the Fairwind Films website, right about in the About section, you write, "We are a group of scientists, philosophers, theologians, and artists who believe that common ground, integration, and synthesis of knowledge from a wide variety of disciplines is not only possible, but necessary for the future of humanity." Wow, that's some pretty cool, heady stuff. But it speaks to, I think, some of what you were just talking about in your introduction. Tell us more of why you felt a need to approach this film and these film projects in that way.
Sure. Well, the type of conflict model, which is what we see a lot of, and in, until very recently, most of the leaders in the scientific community were invested in the conflict model, which is that science has its domain, which is kind of the truth, and religion has its domain, which is myth, and there's no connection between them. And in fact, science is constantly having to battle this idiotic myth over here that's leading people astray, right? And now we're getting into the synthesis model where people are beginning to understand this. I'm talking about leaders of the scientific community and some leaders on the religious side. But I mean, from my perspective, it's looking like leaders in the scientific community are actually making a little bit more movement towards the synthesis model. And religious fundamentalists are having a little bit more difficulty sort of stepping up to the plate and moving over into the direction to really make the synthesis thing happen. Now, this is my perspective. This is what I'm seeing. But things are happening very quickly right now. Just recently, Neil deGrasse Tyson endorsed the simulation hypothesis. This is an unbelievable advance in the promotion of that idea because he is essentially a diehard materialist.
Well, but see, I have to wonder, and I didn't know that, Kent, so that's really interesting. My experience has been with those folks that when they do that, they always leave a very careful back door that allows them to back up into all that, back into materialism, you know, because the full impact of what you're saying in the film and with the simulation hypothesis is connected to this fundamental idea of consciousness and what is the nature of consciousness. So we kind of talk around that. You do an awesome job in really talking about all the key elements. But when we really put someone's feet to the fire and say, okay, is consciousness 100% a product of the brain that ends when a physical body death ends? That then becomes a lot harder, I think, to pin these guys down. At least that's been my experience.
Yeah, and there's a lot. It's a very subtle, deep, rich conversation there. There's emotional bias, and then there's an emotional investment in a worldview. There's also professional concerns. No one wants to be ridiculed within their own field, right? So they have to be very careful about how they ease over into this new paradigm. And we haven't seen anything like this. Really, this is going back to the Newtonian world shift. I mean, that's the level that we're at right now. Things are tipping right now, and the paradigm is actually changing. We're witnessing this happening, and it doesn't happen overnight. The fact that someone like Neil deGrasse Tyson could come out and publicly endorse an idea with the implications that the simulation hypothesis has, I think is noteworthy. And then, you know, other people immediately stepping forward, Elon Musk, whatever, you know, you can talk about whether he has the qualifications to make such an endorsement or whatever. But the point is that the idea is catching on, and people who are recognized thinkers are saying, you know what, the explanatory power of this model is just too great. It solves a lot of problems that are unsolvable under the strict materialist paradigm, and I'm going to overcome my emotional bias, and I'm going to go with this. We're going to take a chance. This is what bold scientists do. They look at something with a lot of explanatory power, and they say, you know what? Somebody has to step over this line, and I'm going to do that.
Absolutely, and you do a nice job in the film of really laying out in very clear terms what is at stake in terms of choosing one set of findings versus another set of findings. And you make it clear that it's just unreasonable to choose this set of findings over here that consistently over and over again are not producing results that scientists would normally consider affirming their position. And on the other hand, piling up again, experiment after experiment, top scientists, top journals that affirm that the counter hypothesis seems to be carrying the day in every way we look at it from every angle, right?
Sure, absolutely. And there's also the idea of progress behind all this. Ever since the Enlightenment period, the materialist paradigm has been incrementally built up as a way of understanding the experience that we're having. Okay. And they had a lot of success with it. That was designed to undermine the sort of divine right to rule of monarchs. And, you know, there were terrible abuses of power by the popes and so forth that spurred this whole mechanical view of the universe as a way of undermining the narratives of the church. And I think that it was justified at the time. Now, after hundreds of years of building up this alternative, to find that a close examination of physical matter reveals a connection to consciousness, which actually undermines strict materialism, it's a little bit much. And I think it's completely understandable for people who are invested in materialism to be skeptical that such, you know, because they're afraid that they're going to be reinforcing the claims of those religious folks and who are then going to say, see, we told you so. We've been saying this all along. And so, you know, back to the whole emotional bias thing.
So, Kent, let me take you in a couple of different directions here along a skeptico line, if you will. You know, I'd like to push people a little bit, and I do have to push you on one point, and that is the film, The Simulation Hypothesis, is fantastic. As I said, rich in science, but also very accessible and breaks some things down that folks have probably heard about a dozen times before. The double slit experiment, the observer effect, quantum entanglement, and you just do a fabulous job of explaining that. And then, more importantly, as you were just talking about, explaining how that completely contradicts, undermines, falsifies materialism, naturalism, physicalism, all this simplistic, you're a biological robot in a meaningless universe stuff that is the way that I like to put it. But, and you knew there was a but coming in all that, are you stretching the metaphor too far? I always get a little bit nervous when we say things like, therefore, we've falsified this. It has some aspects of the simulation model from a philosophical standpoint kind of fitting better. Therefore, we live in a pixelated world that works like a computer simulation. I wonder sometimes if we're stretching the metaphor, if we're making a leap there that is, one, unnecessary, and two, maybe completely unfounded, particularly if we jump over and look at it from a spiritual standpoint and what the extended reality folks are telling us. That is, the folks who are scientifically more or less looking at what's happening in these extended consciousness realms, in the spiritually transformative experiences and all the rest. So could you maybe try and fit those two together? Are you stretching the metaphor too far? And do we have to consider extended consciousness and spirituality as a reality in this formula?
Starting with the last point, yes, everything should be considered. I don't believe in censorship or stopping the argument anywhere or saying this is all out of bounds. People consider everything and.
But Kent, that is the legitimate fear of science, because at some point it does reduce to Carl Sagan and how many angels fit on the head of a pin.
Yeah.
Right? Because now we're saying we have to take seriously the idea that other spirit entities work and influence our world. And we can kind of control that in our little psi experiments and our parapsychology experiments. And we can pretend we're doing real work on healing and prayer and all the rest of that. But what we're really saying is, well, everything's up for grabs now. We don't have a clue how any of that stuff works.
I mean, during my time in Berkeley, I became aware of this philosophy of relativism, which I saw as extremely pernicious. And, you know, the relativism being the idea that there is no essential difference between right and wrong. Obviously, there is a difference between ideas that are worth considering and can be backed up with what we like to consider objective evidence, or what there can be a consensus on, at least as far as what a shared experience of repeatable, demonstrable, empirical, you know, process will provide, and something that is completely nonsense, right, and is not backed by anything, and there can never be a consensus because it's all up to the individual to decide how they feel about it. But at the same time, there is always going to be the problem of the limits of knowledge.
You're suggesting that there are those limits, and like I was just alluding to, and maybe you can speak to this specifically, but let's say we were going to do prayer research, which has been done and has been published in peer-reviewed journals. At another level, prayer research, which acknowledges this extended consciousness realm, thereby kind of makes itself kind of unscientific and incomprehensible in a way, because everyone's praying for somebody at some time. I mean, from a control standpoint, it's just a rat's nest that you could never unravel. So you can say, oh, well, we found this little blip in the statistics, and we think that correlates to that. But at another level, we have no way of ever really putting Pandora back in the box and saying, okay, now we can control things because we really do know there's a physical reality out there.
The problem of epistemology is horrible in many ways. I've run into this exact same problem in my research on how emotions affect your ability to accept an idea and act on it. Because emotion can't be quantified in the way that scientific phenomena normally are measured in order to study. You cannot say, for instance, that I am 5 units of angry versus your 3 units of angry. You can't even really say what anger is. What I'm calling anger, you might call resentment. So you see what the problem is, right? Now, there is, for me, there's nothing as important in the human experience as emotion. It's driving sort of how you're responding to everything that's happening around you. Everything meaningful and important really results in a feeling that you're having about what it is, right? So when I see evidence, if it contradicts a claim that I'm invested in, that I've already accepted, it's going to elicit a subconscious emotional response from me, which is then going to drive my ability to integrate that evidence into my worldview. You see what I'm saying, right?
Totally.
Now, okay, that's great. Now, when I talk about this study that I'm doing for my PhD, there are two groups of people, that understand it in the way that you just did, just process that and go, right. And then there's the people that just reject it because these people have a good argument, which kind of relates to what you just said, which is, wait, then you're turning everything into nonsense. You're saying that science is an objective. You're saying that even science is driven by emotional bias. And I'm sitting there going, yeah, scientists are human beings. And there's a lot of examples in science, as you know. Well, let's take Piltdown Man, for example, where the scientists studying it were completely swayed by their emotional bias, and they got sucked in and they invested in the truth of that. And then, oh boy, it turned out to be a hoax. This happens. Science is not perfect. It's practiced by human beings, and scientists have emotions, and they want their preconceived notions to be proven correct. The way that they examine problems and the way that experiments are designed are limited to hopefully provide them with that emotional payoff. Now, you would agree with that, right?
Oh, completely. Yes.
So there. Okay. So now, can we ever really have control of that? I don't know.
I think we do know. And the answer is no. And what you're doing is you're really kind of pulling it down, which is kind of neat, down to a very kind of uncontroversial level that we can all relate to, right? Emotions, right? So we can't get around the fact that we have emotions. What I would kind of nudge you a little bit more with your theological background and say, okay, now we enter into the extended consciousness kind of realm. I'll give you another example. I interviewed this very, very interesting psychotherapy team. His name is Dr. Dan Booth Cohen, and his research partner is Emily Volden. And here's what they did. They said, okay, we know family therapy works, and we understand some of the dynamics of that, right? So there's all these people who do this for a living, and they have their own journals, and that's science, and they publish, and da-da-da-da. And they said, okay, well, let's marry that with the fact that from every way we looked at it, after-death communication seems to happen. There's induced after-death communication. There's assisted after-death communication. There's these continuing bonds model, which is very popular in the grief community now. From a medical standpoint, like you can get insurance for this because continuing bonds and all this. So they said, if there is some reality to after-death communication and we're doing family therapy, should we merge the two together? Could it be that your deceased relatives are impacting? And to a certain extent, that isn't even controversial. We know that the issues you might have with your father, who is now deceased, are impacting your relationships, right? If we take it on a just a totally kind of plain level. We also know, good science again, and I've interviewed Dr. Julie Beischel, who has published work on this, that if we sit you down, Kent, and give you a reading with a medium who we know is a good medium, and you connect with your deceased relative, your dad or your mom, whatever, we can measure your reaction to grief, the amount of severity it has in your life and all this. And we can show that that reading is more effective than therapy, than all the rest of the stuff. So this, I think, is the world that awaits beyond your movie, The Simulation Hypothesis. It, because we have this extended consciousness realm that we now have to look at. We can't just ignore it in the same way that we can't ignore the emotions.
I'm so lucky that I'm able to choose the title of artist for myself, because it provides the most possible freedom to discuss these ideas, right? I don't claim to be a scientist, right? And I don't claim to be a theologian or a philosopher. I claim to be an artist. And so what I do is I work with aesthetic values, okay, to elicit emotional responses, hopefully, you know, uplifting. So now my personal human response to what you're saying is, whether there's any empirical data or some kind of strong correspondence between what a person's feeling and some actual entity that's transferring information across some kind of veil or something, I'm not, you know, this is a very old idea. This is maybe the oldest idea as far as human beings are concerned, you know, with burying of the dead and the idea of an afterlife and so forth.
Right.
It's that idea is not going to go away. Should it be taken seriously in social sciences? Absolutely. Should it be taken seriously in family counseling? I think so.
Should it be taken seriously in physics? I mean, the implications are there in quantum physics. You know, I just had this conversation with a guy who his name is Dr. Sean Carroll. Maybe you've run across him. Caltech, Harvard trained physicist, number one best-selling book in science right now. Interviewed him. Staunch materialist, is not backing off one bit. His recent book is The Big Picture. And he says, hey, there's nothing, you know, it ends, death, it's natural, everything is natural, hardline materialist. So we had this discussion in which I said, well, it's kind of along the lines of your movie. I said, well, Niels Bohr and Schrodinger and many of the leading people saw this issue as consciousness collapsing the wave function as central to the philosophical underpinnings of quantum physics. And he said, no, no, no. He said, no, you got it completely wrong. They didn't think that at all. Well, we went back and looked, and I showed him that after the show, I showed him, you know, that's not true. You're just completely, I don't know how you get a PhD from Harvard in physics and not know these things, but he didn't know these things. But the real point, I guess, is just that what Schrodinger says, and Bohr says almost the same thing, but Schrodinger says it directly, consciousness must survive death. So from a physics standpoint, it comes with the package, I guess what I'm saying. Consciousness surviving bodily death comes with the package, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And part of the problem is the divvying up of philosophy into the sciences and, you know, psychology and
religion.
You know, it's all philosophy. The thing is, it's all philosophy. And Plato understood that ideas about what constitutes an object and a self and a reflection and, you know, that must precede the experience, okay? So obviously, it follows the experience as well. So yes, consciousness survives because it preceded the experience to begin with. This is not new. This is not a new idea. And someone like Schrodinger and Niels Bohr just understood that the idea of archetypes or Platonic forms must be right, that there is something that there is a mental construct about limits that create objects for us to have an experience with. That does not pass with my individual death or the death of my brain or the death of every living thing. The idea that created all this stuff is still going to be there after the construct or the matrix disappears. Now, but we have divided philosophy up into the sciences and religion. So theology and physics now wind up at these opposite poles where they're really just different, you know, they're really just philosophical pursuits. So I hope I didn't wander too far away there, but I guess what I'm...
No, you're awesome. I really, really appreciate everything you're saying. But I am going to pull you back to the question. Are you stretching the metaphor too far when you say we live in a pixelated world and it works like a computer simulation? You know, a lot of hay is made with this idea that consciousness is like a computer. I think the history of science shows us that whatever our latest technology is that's what we latch onto. And we say, we're just like the river, you know, before we had any technology. And then, oh, we're just like the machine when the machine, and now we're just like the computer. Oh, we're just like a computer simulation. Are we stretching the metaphor too far?
Well, it depends on the individual that's receiving that narrative, right? I mean, how are they receiving it? And what kind of emotional response are they having? And is it possible that the metaphor is being stretched too far? Sure, of course it is. But when you're designing a narrative to elicit an emotional response, you back yourself into this corner where you have to provide some kind of logical conclusion. Otherwise, it's just empty, meaningless drivel, right? So you have to like wind up somewhere. And that's the kind of place that you kind of have to wind up at, because that's the imagery and the metaphor that works for people that are having this experience in the information age that we live in now, right? So you're providing an example that's already within their experience that they can relate the narrative to and go, oh, I see. Yes, this could be, I could be an avatar in a game, or, you know, I could be a character in another being's dream or whatever. See what I'm saying?
Oh, I do. It's awesome. From your lips to Ray Kurzweil's ears. That's what I say, you know, because it's like that. I guess that goes with where you're going with your PhD and this kind of broadly looking at how we respond to new information and integrate it in, because I think you've captured it beautifully, is that it works for us and it matters less the extent to which it conforms to something we're going to call real or anything like that. It propels us forward is what I hear you saying, in a way that relates, is relatable for a lot of us.
And what's really real is the emotional experience that you have. If you feel satisfied at the end of receiving the narrative, that's what's real. You're scared in a scary dream and your fear is real. The thing that's chasing you is part of your dream, but the emotion that you're experiencing is the only reality that can ever be traced back to anything that matters. So, you know, as an artist, all I can do is take these aesthetic qualities and kind of, you know, assemble them in a way that hopefully elicits a positive emotional response. That's all I can do. And if someone then says, geez, I think you're stretching that metaphor a little far, all I can say is, well, okay.
That's my job.
I guess, but if it results in a positive emotional experience for the viewer, that's art. I mean, that's what I claim to be doing. So
awesome. Okay. One last question heading around the bend here. This is the kind of my personal issue right now. And I want you to kind of put on your theologian's hat on one hand, and at the same time, you have to wear one of those split hats, you know, like the parents that have two kids and they go to two different schools. The others, I want to put on your scientific hat, because you keep saying you're an artist and that's awesome. And I want everyone to relate to you as an artist because you do great work. But buddy, you're a scientist as well, or you have a science sensibility that I think is really refreshing and will really connect with a lot of people, because you can dig your sleeves up and understand the science and communicate it in a way that's really terrific. So here's my question, I guess, which is, what's love got to do with it? That's my point. And here's why. If you talk to the near-death experience researchers, they say the narrative, to use Kent's term, that everyone wants to talk about is, did I see my dead relatives? How far was I outside of my body? What verifiable information was I found outside of my body. And the near-death experiencer will tell you that all day long and allow you to put it into your survey and run your numbers and come up with all these great statistics. And then he'll say, but you didn't ask me what's the most important thing about my experience. Because I'll tell you what it was. It was love. It was love in a way that I can't even explain to you other than to say, take the most loving thing you've ever had in your life and multiply it times 1,000. And then you walk over and you say, okay, let's leave that near-death experience person and let's walk over to this person who had a spiritually transformative experience, a kundalini experience that happened spontaneously. They were just driving down the road and it happened. And they come back and start saying the same things. It's about love. And they come back to devotional people, religious people, and they say, well, that's what it's about. That's what, forget all the Jesus, baby Jesus myth and all the rest of that. I don't care about that. What I care about is the experience I have of love, of love, of love. We have written that out of the narrative at every turn. And not only has science written it out, but even our newest cutting edge science, our futuristic science of the kind that you're talking about, the near-death experience science, we all want to write love out of it. And I just wonder if we're making a mistake when we do that. Do you have any thoughts about what does love have to do with it?
Well, in order to have the experience of the individual, we have to place a separation between ourselves and wholeness. Just to have just to relate to other individuals and to navigate a world of objects, we have to limit ourselves so severely, right? So, I mean, if I were in Berkeley in a theology class, this is the way I would say it. And almost everyone would agree, at least in Berkeley, that it's unnatural to be limited in this way. We've limited ourselves so severely. From a spiritual standpoint, this is incredibly limited to a highly unusual degree. So love is the desire to be whole again. And that starts with another individual, right, who you want closeness with. Behind that is the ultimate organizing factor. Call it God, call it whatever, but it's really your entire whole self, not divided into 7 billion individuals, right? So we all want to relate, we all want to get closer, but guess what? We have to be separate in order to have an individual experience. So one of the limiting factors of having this experience is that distance and separation. Absence of love creates a desire and a want for love. So we desire closeness because we've created this distance. Individuals are always going to want closeness because as individuals, we've separated ourselves. And that kind of seems like the major tension in the human experience.
Great. Hey, so Kent, tell folks more about what's up with you. You mentioned that you're working towards this PhD at Maine. Is that right?
Yeah.
And so how's that coming along? How's this film project working out for you? And what do you have going on in the future in terms of films or other projects? I'm sure you're probably bogged down and trying to wrap up that PhD. I know that's a lot of work, but do you have some film projects you're working on as well?
The PhD is going very well. My advisor's name is Dr. Tina Passman. She's fantastic. And we're dealing with, it's an interdisciplinary PhD. And so we're trying to pull together people from a lot of different disciplines and reach a consensus that there is a thing called emotional bias, and it affects us in the way that we accept ideas and then the way that we act on those ideas and the kind of narratives that we reinforce and the kind of narratives that we try to diminish in our social circle, in our consensus group. Okay. Yes, that's a lot of work. And I'm kind of just putting that over there. I still have 2 years technically to finish it, but I think it's going to be wrapped up here within the next maybe 6 months.
PhD students always say that.
it's been so long getting it to the point where it is now. Just, oh my God, I could talk about just the process that I've been going through since I left Berkeley and proposed this idea. It's changed tremendously. And I knew there would be some problems getting people to agree, but I never thought that the content of the concept itself would be so divisive. to try to get people to agree that human beings have emotions and that it biases what you accept. It's like nobody wants to reinforce that idea because they feel like they're endangering the validity of their position in whatever discipline they're in. Because if you're a scientist, oh my gosh, that invalidates my scientific thing. If you're in religion, oh, well, wait a minute. Now you're reducing my religious position to a narrative. You know, so it's like nobody wants to admit they're human. Nobody wants to admit their bias and right. But anyway, and then so as far as film goes, this is kind of a secret, but I'm working with Bernardo Kastrup on a science film called Escape from the Cult of Materialism that really talks more about the social constructs and sort of cult-like mentality in terms of coercion and brainwashing that allows the false claims of materialism to be carried through and maintained in a social system the way that false teachings do in any other cult environment. So, you know,
fantastic.
Starting from grade school, you're indoctrinated into this materialist, you know, viewpoint, and then information is basically closed off, at least it always was, okay? At least, you know, in my life, you didn't really have access to information like young people do today with the internet. But the cult really tries to limit your information and shut off any views that would contradict their truth claims. And if anyone knows this, you do. I mean, you know, people will respond negatively and put out negative reviews or whatever, you know, trying to prevent people from even looking at alternative viewpoints that contradict the materialist view. And this is just would be expected in any cult environment. Any information that tends to contradict the claims of the cult is going to be viewed with suspicion, right? So, yeah, that's called Escape from the Cult of Materialism. And that'll probably be done sometime September, October.
Fantastic. Bernardo has been a great friend of the show, and he's been on many times. And I think you couldn't partner with a better person to kind of bring forth that idea. So that's fantastic. We'll definitely have to have both of you guys back on when you wrap that up so we can talk about it more. But until that next time, Ken, I've taken a lot of your time here, but I really appreciate it. And I super appreciate your work and what you've brought forward to people. It's terrific.
Thank you, Alex. I'm a big fan. Thank you very much.
Thanks again to Kent Forbes for joining me today on Skeptico. One question to tee up from this interview: does the simulation hypothesis undermine materialistic science? Does it undermine a reductionistic, matter-based, mind-equals-brain idea that dominates science? Again, folks, I got to tell you, if you haven't seen this movie, it's easy to access. It won't cost you anything to watch it. And you will have the best historical perspective you can get on why it does. But I've tipped off the answer there, but maybe you have a different answer. In either case, I'd love to hear your response to the question. Of course, the place to do it is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. You can jump on over to the forum and let us hear from you there. You can comment directly or leave me a message on Facebook or in the comment section. Any way you want to do it, send me an email, whatever you like. Again, the only thing I ask that you do is that you, one, connect with the people who are interested in this so we can continue to form this community of people who are willing to deal with these big picture questions of science. And another part of that, if you don't want to comment on the show, share the show. Send it to someone that you like. See what they have to say. That is, by the way, the number one way we have of introducing this show to new people. And it's always fun to see new people who stumble into Skeptico and are drawn into this discussion that we're having. Hey, I just heard from a longtime friend of mine, a longtime friend of the show, Rudolf Smit, who is in the Netherlands and has just published a book he's been working on for a long time, titled The Self Does Not Die: Verified Paranormal Phenomena from Near-Death Experiences. It's out. It's on Amazon. Do check it out. It looks really good. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I plan to. I'll have a link in the show notes to that as well. Well, that'll do it for today's episode. I have a number of projects and episodes that I'm working on. I'm playing around with some video ideas. I got some great video. I'm overwhelmed with what to do with it. If anyone has some ideas, suggestions, or wants to offer some help, please let me know. I'd love to hear from you, but that's certainly not required either. So that's going to do it for this time. Do take care, and until next time, bye for now.